fantastic. Well, they're all privately paying the Russians $50 million to sit on the Soyuz spacecraft to get shot up to the space station. That's true. NASA never got involved with private money. They never did. They thought about it a couple of times. John Denver wanted to do it. Let me drop it. You know, that never came off, but he wanted to do that. And eventually, he was going to, since NASA was turning him down, he was going to sign up with the Russians. But he got himself killed in his homemade airplane. And that was the end of that deal, of course. So a lot of these things are true to an extent when it comes to existing people that have already done it and people that have signed up with the Russians to do it. By the way, it costs them now $50 million. It used to cost 20, 30, 40. The number keeps going on. I think the newest one's about $50 million. And yet they're charging the United States $70 million per astronaut to put them up. So I don't know. I think they should get a discount. What do you think, Dick? Back to that WS2M.
The one that's a little bit more realistic is Brunson, Richard Brunson, I think his name is, or Virgin Atlantic, and I think it's called Space One. And for a slightly smaller fee, he'll put you into weightlessness on a suborbital flight, an arc which I think goes to 100 kilometers of altitude, which I believe they consider the threshold of space. Is it 50 kilometers or I think it's 100 kilometers. So Bronson can get you up there for roughly how many dollars? And I think, he's already done it twice with one of his own pilots. And I guess he's getting very close to the point where he's now going to be taking the general public to space. So you've told us this before. I'm a little bit forgetful, so run that by again as to what Virgin Atlantic is doing, Paul. WS2N, T2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, yeah. See, now he's got hardware and everything. I mean, he's got proof of intention. No question about it. He was the guy that he got the Ansani Prize, for sending a spacecraft up and then turning it around within 2 weeks and sending it up again. You know, suborbital flight. And got the money on that. I mean, this guy's a reliable, this will happen. Now it's called Spacecraft One, and now they have Spacecraft Two, and that'll be piloted by two people, and then you're going to put at least six passengers on board. At least, I think the spacecraft holds eight people. And again, it will be suborbital, and that thing has gone through some test flights. It hasn't gone to full orbit, not orbit, full apogee yet. But they're getting there, maybe within a year, maybe less. And that's $200,000 each, and as many people signed up for that already. So that's affordable for some rich people. But $50 million for the Russians, you got that's big money. But $200,000 is doable for a couple of rich people. Thank you, Dick.
You and I could, John, I could pool our resources, and one of us could go. I think I told you guys, Ken Spencer, I think his name, one of the prominent members of the Astronomical Society of Long Island, did get a flight on the weightlessness flight, the Vomit Comet, some people call it, the 707, I think it is, which made something like 18 separate two-minute or a little bit less than two-minute arcs, parabolic arcs, where he was weightless for more than a minute, almost 2 minutes. And he took a whole lot of photographs, presented that at an Astronomical Society of Long Island meeting about 3 months ago. And Ken had a real good time. It was one of these deals, where this organization would take a senior citizen who had a lifelong dream, and they would fulfill it. And his lifelong dream was to experience weightlessness, and they fulfilled that dream for him. I think he had to pay the transportation to get there, but the actual flight itself was paid for by the organization. And as I said, he took a whole lot of pictures, and I could tell he had a grand old time. And he's a guy who is a pilot, so he had a fair amount of training, and therefore he didn't get any seasickness, if you know what I mean. I don't know what the price is to fly on that. I think it's a NASA-sponsored aircraft. Therefore, I don't know if that's open to the general public. For $200,000 to fly to space, and I'm guessing the total amount of time you're going to be in space is probably well under 10 minutes. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Oh, yeah, with the Francis deal, yeah. You know, you'll see the horizon and all, you know, what it looks like, the curved horizon, and you'll be weightless for, I think you said a couple of minutes, I think you're right, but a couple of minutes, and then you're going to start coming down. But he's got this interesting wing in the back that this whole thing changes, you know, straight out to like a 90-degree angle, and that's what slows him down coming through the atmosphere, so no parachutes involved or anything, you know, he took him down to land. It's doing good. Composites, I think, is the one that is making it for him. Tan's group, I think, is contracted out with them, and it's called Virgin. Is it Galactic Virgin or Virgin Galactic? I don't know. But Richard Branson. But the, the weightless plane. Let me drop it. I think John knows C-135, I think. I think John, he mentioned that one. I think that's what it is. And now, there's two of them that NASA still has it, and now there's a private company involved with this. And they're also getting, I think they're financially involved with NASA somehow, but there's this private company doing it as well. In fact, a while back, a couple of few years ago, they had Stephen Hawking. I think I mentioned that before. He went on, you know, he, the wheelchair bound. No, not in this thing. Then he had him flying around in this thing. So he got the thrill of his life and set on that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, he has so little use of his arms and legs. It's going to be a little bit difficult for me to see how he could appreciate the weightless flight. Ken was waving his arms and hands, and in some of the photographs, I would look at the way he's holding his hands out as if they were wings, and the way he tilted his hands. I was saying as I was looking at those photographs to the audience, Ken, you didn't use enough aileron control. And various people who understand aerodynamics were thinking that was kind of funny. Alrighty. So, do you happen to know how many people have signed up for Branson's Virgin Galactic? Would it be a large number of hundreds or even thousands of people, do you think, Paul, WS2N, K2LAW?
I don't remember. Last time I saw something, some lady, I don't know, she was in the middle of the country somewhere. I think she's an old lady. You know, she was no kid. She was an older lady. I think she's got some health problems or something, and she's in a hurry to get, you know, before her health deteriorates, she wants to do this. But I forget how many dozens or so people have put down at $200,000, well, probably a down payment, I guess. But it's yet to happen, you know. I mean, once it gets rolling, you know, you should be able to turn this thing like around on a regular basis. I don't know how many flights a year, but you know, should be pretty good. I guess if he gets enough flights in, and maybe a second spacecraft, maybe the price will drop a little bit there. And maybe the ARRL, maybe they put enough money to send you up there. I talk about space, but I'm not going up. When I was younger, yeah, but now that I'm older, you gotta be nuts. Back to you, Dick.
It's a JHR for the query. JHR, go right ahead.
So you think this has two questions. A, what would be the transit time to Mars? And B, what would be the incentive value?
Yeah, that's sort of the questions that I'm asking. I believe it takes about a year and a half to get there, during which time you're way above the protective shell you're getting with the Earth. Let me drop for a second.
8 months to Curiosity 6.
Okay, that was a fast flight. I didn't know it was that fast. I thought it was closer to a year. But 8 months. 8 months of continuous weightless exposure to all of the cosmic rays, solar wind, ultraviolet, and whatever. See, on Earth, you've got a tremendous amount of protection from the atmosphere, the ionosphere, and the Van Allen belt. The magnetic field around the Earth is a kind of a magnetic shield. A hell of a lot of things get deflected by that. That's what gives you the aurora borealis and aurora australis. The ionosphere gives you a lot of ultraviolet protection. The atmosphere gives you a lot of protection. You're away from all of those protective shells when you're on that spacecraft. When you're on Mars, you have essentially no protection. There's no real atmosphere, no real magnetic field, no Van Allen belt, no ionosphere on Mars. So it's a really wicked environment. I think one possible reason, not only the cost, let me drop it.
KC2QAQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized, not only is there a huge cost involved of getting you there, and there isn't anywhere near the right amount of hardware to get you back, but I don't think you want to come back. I think by the time you're there for a while, your body is going to be heavily damaged. And so I don't think you want to come back. And the incentive to go there, it's sort of like being the first man on the moon. There's a big incentive to doing that. And to bring back lunar soil to analyze, to figure out how the moon got there. Scientifically, there's a good reason. But now, is there anything else on the moon other than the backside of it away from the Earth? Would be a great place to put a telescope, optical or radio telescope. So scientifically, it's got some possible benefits. Let me drop. But it again is an extremely cold. Well, in the case of the moon, at high noon it goes to ridiculously high temperatures. At midnight it goes to ridiculously low temperatures. And there's no atmosphere. And 1/6 gravity. And yes, if you play golf and if you want to hop around in 1/6 gravity, that would be kind of fun at first. But what are you going to do after that? So, a colony on the moon. I don't know. And Mars is a hell of a lot worse as I see it. It's a very dry desert. It's a faraway planet. I'm guessing that the degree of difficulty of getting there is about 1,000 times greater than the degree of difficulty to get to the moon. And you see how difficult it was to get to the moon with the Apollo program. So what do you get in return? You send an unmanned spacecraft there, like Curiosity, the Mars Surface Laboratory, where it makes a whole lot of measurements, and by telemetry mails you all the readings back home, that's valuable. But to put a man there with all of his life support, which in that environment is extremely difficult, it's hard to justify. KC2QIQ, K2LIW, I bet you're not going to volunteer for this, Glenn. You got it, Glenn.
No, absolutely not, Dick. I definitely would not volunteer for this, but I think if you look deeply enough into that space study, what you'll probably find out is that the people who are volunteering, these astronauts of the future, were probably their spouses. You remember, like Ralph Kremden, Alice, to the moon. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, you're making a joke out of it, but just to go into space, the stresses you put your body into during the acceleration, deceleration, weightlessness section, and then repeating all of that to come back home again, you better be in pretty good health. Because on that trip, if during the stress of the launch you start going into a cardiac arrest, there's not very much they can do for you. You better be in very good health. I mean, before they'll let you solo, I remember when I soloed in my flight training as a youngster, I didn't go very far with it, by the way. You have to go through a medical to make sure you're not going to be the pilot of an airplane that suddenly becomes unconscious, which means you're going to turn into one heck of a hazard. So you got to go through a medical test, and that medical test has to be kept current. in that aircraft before you're allowed to continue the solo in it. So the FAA has got some pretty strict rules. Therefore, I'm sure Richard Branson has also got some pretty good medical requirements that must be met, except for somebody who is terminally ill. I could see him making an exception for a person who is terminally ill, who is willing to sign one hell of a release. Let me turn it over to Paul for any further comments on this one. And can you see any good motivation for sending a human being to Mars, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Well, just for the financial benefits for the space programs of all the countries, I think when it happens, it's not going to be one country. You've got to have multiple countries involved. It'd be like the International Space Station. You have 16 countries involved in that. And I think something similar is going to happen with the Mars first landing. It's got to be open. You know, and everybody's going to want to get involved in this area. As it is already, European Space Agency is going to build a service module for the Orion spacecraft. We're building the Orion spacecraft here, and it's really similar technology to what they've already built five times and sent to the International Space Station, called the ATV, the Automatic Transfer Vehicle. So already they're involved, and you're going to have a collection of countries that are going to be your first shot to Mars. And it keeps an interest, a tremendous interest, and it keeps the dollars flowing. I mean, and eventually it's going to happen anyway, but I think it's very important for the young people to get involved in knowing that there's actually going to be a person going there in the future. But gaining science information and all, now you just send one robot, one curiosity after the other, and that's the way to go. Back to you.
C2WGB with a comment.
And John recognized. Okay, you make it sound, Paul. I can see how NASA is not saying anything negative about a Mars mission, because essentially all of our youth believes that in their lifetime they will see mankind standing on Mars. And it's an exciting sounding project, and for those who have got an interest in space flight, space travel, they want to be part of it. So when it comes to creating enthusiasm for our youth, that's a good thing. But to really do it, you make it sound, Paul, like you think it's really going to happen, even with these one-way missions. As you can tell, I'm kind of skeptical. Let's see what John's got to say about this, then I'm going to turn it over to you for a comment on that, Paul. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, as far as sending volunteers to Mars, I think in a way it's a good idea, because we do need people to go there and experience and give us human data as far as health issues, what can actually be done. We have to get some kind of a schedule of what they can perform, what's realistic and what isn't. And these volunteers will be giving their life, as many of our predecessors have done. So it may be a good thing. You know, not for them, but it'll be something for history. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
KC2WGB. Bernie recognized and one other, but Glenn is ahead of you. So, Glenn, go right ahead with your comment. It was Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
I don't think the one-way mission is ever going to happen. That's my bet. I'd be first one to say I'd be very surprised if that ever happened, especially in my lifetime. Did I think that was going to happen, an actual Mars landing when I was younger? Yeah, I thought the same. I'm sure today's young people think the same. I thought we would have been back to the moon. I thought we would have been colonized by now. And now, how many years later? I mean, Armstrong dead. First woman, Sally Ride, she's gone. You've got the third person to land on the moon, Pete Conrad, he's dead. There's one right after Irwin. Irwin's dead of a heart attack or something. Schmidt is gone. I mean, you're going to come to the point where you're going to have like one or two astronauts that have actually landed on the moon. I mean, these guys were hoping that they would see that guy's return in their lifetime. And they're a lot older than we are, Dick. And look what's happening. Back to you.
2SLW with a comment.
SLW, you're after Bernie. And I think Bernie is after Glenn. I think Glenn wanted to make a comment. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
No, Dick, it wasn't me. KC2QIQ.
Okay, Bernie, you got it. Bernie, would you volunteer to go to either Moon or Mars? The Bernie I know, the Hunt family member that I know, is pretty level-headed, and I don't think he's going to go for that. But maybe I'm wrong. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2LIW.
Well, if you ask the Bernie now, no. If you ask the Bernie 20 years ago, absolutely. The thing you have to remember is that mankind has always had a desire to explore and to go to places they've never been before for practically no good reason. Why do people climb Mount Everest knowing that every minute they spend above 30,000 meters that they're killing brain cells and that it's only a matter of time before they die? Why did Cook and Magellan and many others get in their ships and head off over the horizon, not knowing what's out there, but going to go find out? That's the reason we'll go to Mars. You draw up a number of science fiction reasons of what happens. You know, Mars is the lifeboat if something happens to Earth, et cetera, et cetera. But the practical reason that'll drive it is it's the unknown. And the practical reason that we as taxpayers will pay for it is because it's the unknown and it's exploration. Will it happen in my lifetime? I don't know. Paul and I had an interesting conversation at Field Day just about how space travel is a young man's game. It's the braveness. It's the willingness. It's that concept of we're going to get in this spaceship and there is no backup. As we get older and have families and responsibilities, that becomes less possible. But it's a young man and a young woman's game. I don't mean to be sexist about this, that there are some women that are incredible explorers. But I think that's the reason that we'll go.
To a very, very small degree, I have gone to space. That's my viewpoint. When I'm standing on top of my 100-foot tower, knowing that I'm strapped in with a safety harness, I've got a radio strapped to my chest where I can holler Mayday, and if I'm calling down to the wife, hey, something has grown and gone wrong inside my body, I can't move, send the rescue team. And I know that the local fire department, their hook and ladder, is not going to get into my woods very easily. They're not going to be able to get up 100 feet. They're going to have to get a very special person with high-angle rescue experience, with mountaineering equipment that can climb 100 feet of tower, strap me into this hardware, and slowly lower me to the ground. So when I'm on top of that tower, I'm really off of this earth and very difficult to recover. And the worst situation, worst or best, let me drop. The worst or best situation, depending on your point of view, that I ran into is I was up there one day, and it started snowing pretty hard while I'm doing a repair. And it snowed so hard that the ground below me, 100 feet away, disappeared. I could look down the tower, and I could see the tower getting lighter and lighter in view, and pretty soon it faded away in the snow. I could not see the ground. So I'm standing on top of this tower in the snowstorm. It's a quiet snowstorm with great big flakes, and every single direction I looked in azimuth elevation, I saw nothing but whiteness, and I felt like I was not part of this earth. And if I had to request a recovery at that time, that would have been very difficult. So, to a small degree, I might have been in space, if you know what I mean, except the fact that I wasn't in weightlessness. So, you got to think ahead about all the safety equipment and each one of your operations. You got to plan pretty carefully in an operation like that, because in some cases, your one hand holds from a pretty violent death. And I'm not quite that suicidal. I don't want to waste a good ham radio operator that way. What I think is a good ham radio operator. Mr. SLW, let's see now, GHR, he comes first in SLW in that case. GHR, did you get a chance to make your comment? K2RIW and TechNet. Okay, John, N2SLW. I think you're in Maspeth, and I do remember reading in Newsday, I think it was, a year or two ago, that there was a bit of a controversy as to whether or not a cell tower was going to be allowed in Maspeth. I might have you confused. N2SLW, K2RIW. You got it, John.
Okay, thank you, Dick. Yes, you're correct about Maspeth. As far as the cell tower, it wasn't mine. Bernie covered some of the points I wanted to mention. One of the tenets of all these science fiction stories we grew up with was that Mars would be there in case anything ever happened to Mother Earth, that we need an outpost for humanity with knowledge of humanity besides just a golden disk with real live DNA walking around. And Mars is the only place we've got close by. We'll learn so much, we'll probably maybe even be able to build things, maybe even in Mars orbit. I think they should go. Okay, back to the net.
Okay, you've got a pretty positive attitude about it, John. As I see it, it's going to take an extremely large amount of dollars, resources, hardware, to get an extremely small number of human beings on the surface of Mars in a partially survivable environment. It's going to take a lot of resources to get a man there. So as Mars to be a backup place for humanity on Earth to go to, it makes good sounding science fiction. I'm having a problem with it. I don't think so. I think you're way ahead of the game of not dirtying your own nest. Don't dirty the Earth. Make sure you treat the Earth very well. This is the best thing you've got. And you really don't want to go to Mars. Something like 150 degrees below zero. No atmosphere. No ionosphere. No magnetic field. No protection from ultraviolet. No protection from solar wind. No food. No warmth. Almost no water. You're going to have to do the amount of resources required to make a habitable environment in that place is really stretching it. The sheer cost, it cost $35 billion in 1970 money to get a few men to the moon for a couple of days at a time. $35 billion in 1970 dollars. That's probably in the vicinity of $150 billion today just to go to the moon. And Mars is probably 1,000 times more difficult.
Repeater, time out.
The sheer cost of getting a man to Mars is going to require a pooling of the resources of every one of the developed nations on this planet. And the first thing they're going to ask is, what in the world do I get in return for that investment? That's not an easy one to answer. It makes good sci-fi. But I think we're talking about multiple trillions of dollars to get a human being onto Mars. If you look at it in pure dollar cost, it's not easy to justify. So you can tell I'm skeptical. We'll soon find out. Well, I don't think anybody within the sound of my voice in their lifetime is going to see a human being standing on Mars, and I'm skeptical about whether or not your grandchildren will see a human being standing on Mars. I'll admit it's kind of possible. Let me drop.
It's a while.
I heard Bernie and then another double. I'll admit that there's a hell of a lot of scientific development that's going to take place. We're going to find better ways of getting propulsion, better ways of getting life support systems, better ways of recycling. To send a human being to Mars, the sheer requirement of just food, water, and air. We all forget about the fact that you consume in 1 year an amount of oxygen, water, and food that if you pack the oxygen as tight as you can pack it in cylinders, and the food and whatever you pack it as tight as you can, it will fill up the volume of your house, and it has approximately the volume of your house, the mass of your house. That's what is required in consumables to sustain you for 1 year. And to ship that much material there, wow. KQIO, go ahead, Bernie. KQIW.
You talk about the cost of putting a man on the moon. You also have to remember that many economists estimate that there was $100 billion worth of economic benefit of having done that. So it's, by many economists, they don't consider that to have been an economic loss, but an economic gain.
You make a very good point, Bernie. I think NASA usually claims that the side, the fallout of the space program is roughly 6 to 1. For every dollar you spend on a NASA project, you get $6 worth of value in return with the development of medical hardware, scientific hardware, procedures for doing manufacturing in better ways. You get something like a 6 to 1. In the case of unmanned space vehicles, in the case of a moon mission, I agree with that. Are you still going to get a 6 to 1 benefit in the process of going to Mars is an interesting question. Who was the other person who signed in? Give me a call, letters and name, K2LIW. There was another person who signed in at the same time Bernie did. Who was that? Okay. Anybody with any further questions before we go to the so-called deeper section now? Anybody with any further questions on the subject of space, what Paul has said, and what any of us have said in the last few minutes? Any further comments or questions? Give me a call, letters right now, K2LIW.
K2LIW.
Glenn recognized. Was there another person?
WS2N.
Glenn and Paul in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
There we go. Yeah, I think, Dick, overall that, you know, my feeling on this one is that you're going to see a lot more unmanned craft going to Mars, at least in the near future anyway. As far as the manned mission goes, I think you're going to need to see a paradigm. There'll be some technological change that'll have to take place that'll make spacecraft, or at least a manned spacecraft, much more achievable. But I think right now, with the present technologies and the science that we have right now for a manned space mission, I think people might sign up for it, but the closer it gets to the day to take off, I think that number's going to dwindle down really quick. But I anticipate there's going to be some technological breakthrough first, but it'll be probably all unmanned, which is going to probably get significantly better in the near future. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to NASA supplying a remote robot. The way we now have unmanned aerial vehicles that do an awful lot of our welfare for us without putting human life at risk, remotely piloted vehicles can do a huge number of tasks of monitoring the atmosphere or doing warfare-type things in Afghanistan, for instance. So it's time that we developed a repair vehicle that can visit our spacecraft in an unmanned manner to do those repairs. I think it's overly time that we do that. John, were you the next person who want to make a comment? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
No, Dick, not me.
Bernie, was it you?
Glenn.
Go ahead, Paul. WS2N. I'm forgetful. You got a call.
Yeah, I remember that 6-to-1 ratio number back in the 70s. They talked about that. And you're talking about that all these years later. So I guess that number hasn't changed. And economically, like Bernie said, that's the one. All the countries are interested with their space programs. The idea of getting a Japanese astronaut on board the space station, that was very good for Japan. I mean, they contributed so much to the space station. The same thing for the European Space Agency. Canada just recently had their first commander on the space station. But these are all big economic pluses for all these countries. And they were originally for the United States and Russia. And now, the manned space program wound down with Apollo, there was so much money and engineering capital invested that, let me drop it, that all the unmanned rocket missions at the time, all your Pioneer missions and your Viking missions to Mars, the two that landed on Mars and the two orbiters, Voyager spacecraft that are still operating today beyond Pluto. And these missions all would have never been funded if it wasn't for the manned space program. that. And right now, you don't even have a Americans being launched from our soil, and that's got to change real quick before the interest is lost. The average taxpayer are not scientists or engineers, but they are. They would, you know, they would be explorers. They can relate to that thing. Back to you, WS2M.
Thank you, Paul. I'm now going to give a nice long pause. People in the outer areas want to make comments, and I'm getting the impression that the people in the outer areas, Echolink or IRLT, if we don't give a long enough pause, they don't have a chance to sign in. I'm going to give a nice long pause right now, and you guys that are out there having trouble signing in, please give it a try right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, I'm not hearing anybody at this time, and they may have become discouraged because they had such trouble trying to sign in. And if Eric, are you still available? I know that you're making modifications to the system by way of a radio link, for instance. So will the delay time for the resetting of the Echolink and IRLP, I wonder, will that be changing in the near future? You might want to make a comment on that if you're available, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Okay, maybe Eric's not available. Now, the YouTube video that was distributed by Wes shows a large, round, spherical object with two great big connectors, one off the north end and one off the south end. It's a so-called ionization tube. It's a partially evacuated glass envelope, large glass envelope, with some form of gas inside, argon, neon, whatever, we're not quite sure. And the person who is using this is sending I'm guessing what he's doing is applying a high voltage DC with an AC signal, one or two AC signals superimposed. And when he does the superimposed AC signal, that's a guess on my part, you do see a pattern that crawls across the tube. And now, is the tube displaying a standing wave in space where you're actually viewing a radio wave? Is one possible interpretation. Let me drop. There's another possible interpretation. He's viewing that with an electronic camera. The electronic camera has a certain frame rate. As such, you get a stroboscopic effect. I could have a rotating bicycle wheel in front of a modern-day electronic camera, and if I rotate the bicycle wheel just right, I'll see the wheel appear to slowly turn backwards. We've all seen that effect on the early Western movies, where the spokes of a wagon wheel will look like they're slowly rotating backwards, because of the stroboscopic effect between the frame rate of the motion picture camera and the rotation rate of the wheel. So whether or not this YouTube video is showing a stroboscopic effect caused by the camera is an interesting question. The thing that John and I have some disappointment about when we see some of these YouTube videos is that the raw information as to what was the power supply, how many volts, what was the AC signal superimposed on the power supply? Let me drop. Was it one single AC signal? What was the frequency of the AC signal? The magnitude of the AC signal? Was there more than one? So without a schematic diagram telling you what you're viewing, I mean, just to have a person say, look how exciting that is. I've got a standing wave that can move slowly back and forth to the left and right. As he's changing the frequency of what sounds like an audio generator, you do hear the squealing sound of an audio generator, which I'm guessing is a high-power audio amplifier, superimposing an AC signal on top of a DC signal going into this ionization tube. So there's such a large amount of missing information as to what is being displayed. It is difficult to say that you're seeing a radio wave in free space. It would be nice to say you're seeing a radio wave as a standing wave in free space inside of this ionization tube. I'm not willing to make that leap of faith yet, with the raw data that we've been given. So it's an exciting looking video, but it does give us an awful lot of questions, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, at first, the spherical object that you have seen is an EMEM device, which was called Royal Rife. And that was the invention of 1900. The early, that's what the literature says, the early inventors of it were prosecuted for their works, and the inventor had the lab burned down and destroyed, whatever, doesn't matter, that's what they say. And that was the James Baer, Dr. James Baer. It is, if you just Google EMEM, EMEM plasma, what is it, Royal Rife, R-I-F-E, let me jump. It was a spark-up device. It was operated with a high voltage and a fast-acting spark. So we don't say about the interval. We say about the continuous spark in a very fast rate. Now, the guy wasn't really doing it with the camera at first, but the guy was seeing the phenomena at first. I understand you're skeptical, you're entitled to it, but I have a few questions. If, say, that's what you see, is that what you see? One question would be, are we dealing with visualization of electromagnetic waves? That's the first question, and then I have a few others.
It would take quite a leap of faith to say that that black area that traverses across this blue arc, there's a blue arc across the whole tube, and as he sets the controls of the sine wave generator, it sounds like a sine wave generator, and as he makes the sine wave go up and down in frequency and he sets it just right, you see a black band that moves across this illuminated tube. You could call it a very large diameter neon tube. That's not what it is, but you could call it that, with a blue glow inside, a continuous blue glow, and you see a black band walk across this fairly long tube. The tube looks like it's almost a foot long. And so, are we seeing a stroboscopic effect? Possibly. Is that a visualization of one single pulse of an RF wave? I doubt it. A real RF wave. I personally have generated the hardware that would take a X-band signal in free space. Let me drop. And so I, with great care, at the kilowatt level, generated in the milliwatt level going into a traveling wave tube that had 40 some odd dB of gain. At the milliwatt level, I was generating a signal that was 250 picoseconds long. That's a quarter of a nanosecond long, was the envelope of a signal at 12 gigahertz. And when you go through the mathematics of that, you'll see that the envelope consisted of three cycles of 12 gigahertz. So I was making pulses, a million pulses per second, where each individual pulse consisted of three sine waves of a 12 gigahertz signal, and then a whole lot of space in between before the very next pulse came along. And I was doing that a million times per second. And I was putting that through a high-power traveling wave tube, transmitting that into a anechoic chamber, a 300-foot anechoic chamber, as a radar-like device in order to be able to identify the reflecting objects that were unknown, which objects in the chamber were doing reflecting, which to identify the unknown reflecting objects in that chamber. Let me drop. So I can tell you the degree of difficulty to make one small bundle of RF energy and send it out in free space. It takes a lot of effort. and I didn't see any evidence that this particular YouTube video, that the person doing that, had done anything like that. So that little black area that you're seeing in the middle of this great big long illuminated tube, is that a particular single sine wave in space? Wow. There's so many steps you'd have to go through to get there. I'm very skeptical. And I'll hear a lot of words of what the generating equipment would be like in order to do that. No ordinary equipment can do that. It's very specialized equipment. Now, what normally happens, let me drop. With many of these YouTube videos, if you do enough searching of the adjacent videos, in other words, that particular author, that may be video number 7 of a whole series. So when you look at the adjacent videos of that same guy or group of people, sometimes you can find a little bit more of the data, of the explanation of what you're looking at. But because I tried to do something like that, to try to make a single pulse in space of RF energy traveling out at the speed of light, going into a chamber, reflecting, and coming back, and I measure the direction of arrival and the time delay and the amplitude. The direction of arrival is like shining a flashlight around the room. The time delay tells me how many feet out there was the reflecting object. And the amplitude of the echo tells me how big was the object that's doing the reflecting. You put that all together and you can say, aha, there it is. Somebody dropped a nail in the anechoic chamber into the anechoic the absorbing material that was on the floor. And it's out there 13 feet in that direction. Go get it. So that's what they... I was building a radar that had a half a foot or a third of a foot of range resolution. To the nearest third of a foot, I could identify each one of the echoing devices in that room. That's the reason why I was making pulses that sharp, that often, and that small in pulse duration. Ordinarily, a radar is blind for the first mile, and then from 1 mile to 150 miles, it tells you what's going on. I was building a radar that was blind for the first foot, and then from there to the next 300 feet, it told you what was there. A very specialized radar. So I don't think this circuit...
Repeater, timeout.
So as you can tell, Wes, I don't think that this circuit comes close to the requirements to do that. I didn't say it's impossible, but it's going to take a lot of fancy, very high-speed hardware. The degree of difficulty of building a pulse-forming network that has 30-some-odd decibels of on-off ratio at a quarter of a nanosecond rate. My very broadband doubly balanced mixers that were doing the pulsing only had a 15-decibel on-off ratio. So I had to cascade two of them. And at first you say, okay, each one's going to give you 15 dB of on-off. You put two of them together, you're going to get 30 dB of on-off. Sounds good. Not at all. Because the pulse that came out of the first doubly balanced mixer in the cable was only a few inches long. The whole dot pulse in the cable at the speed of propagation in the cable was only a small number of inches long. So I had to carefully time things so that the first doubly balanced mixer created a pulse. The second doubly balanced mixer had to turn on and off at just the right time when the first pulse came along. I called it the alligator fix. You know what an alligator does. Let me drop.
Dick, we have only 6 minutes left. I would like to go with a few more questions.
Okay, so an alligator has to open his mouth at just the right instant when the target is coming through and close his mouth at the right time. My second mixer had to do that. So it's very difficult. So I don't think that is what we would like it to be, Wes. So my question to you is, do any of the adjacent videos give you any hint as to what the rest of the hardware looked like? N2XJN, KQLAW?
Very simple. N2XJN. There is an electromagnetic experimental machine, that's what EMEM stands for. What you could do is you could take 555 timbre based square wave generator. No discrete function generator is needed. And then you can go to 10 kilohertz of the maximum frequency with it. That's what it does. Now, that's what you see is what you see, and that's what you say is what you say. I see it differently, but that's okay. Which you see has a few other things. What are the dependencies of the positioning of the standing wave? I would name it compression wave. And there is definitely standing wave. You have a black spot in the middle, they could move left and right, and then you have a sort of circular on left-hand side and right-hand side. And this is anode and cathode, nothing in between. What is the significance of dividing lines, separating layers from the left-hand side and right-hand side? Because you don't have only one transitional sort of circle or ring. You have many of them. And would that be sort of a spectral layers according to Maxwellian quantizing? Because we have that separation. And if there is a compression wave, if there is a standing wave, why don't you see it?
The only way you can make a speed of transmission of a radio wave much, much smaller than the speed of light is you must have extremely high dielectric or magnetic mu materials. That plasma inside that tube is not. The velocity of propagation of a radio wave going through that tube is going to be within a 2-to-1 ratio of the speed of light. A tube is a foot long. At the speed of light, a signal going through there takes 1 nanosecond, and if I can slow it down by 2-to-1, 2 nanoseconds. You cannot get a 1 nanosecond timing out of a 555 timer. You're 1,000-to-1 wrong. It can't do that. So you can't make a wave stop in the middle of that tube in a nanosecond using a 555 timer. N2XJN, K2LIW.
So what is in that? What is that black spot in the middle that is that has a sort of rings on the left and right hand side and you can move left and right?
The so-called Barkhausen effect. Whenever you create an arc in a plasma inside of a partially evacuated tube, doing nothing but DC with some inductance of the wiring, maybe with an RF choke, a filter choke in series with it, you can get all kinds of standing wave things by putting nothing but pure DC with a slightly inductive circuit into a plasma arcing device. It doesn't even require external modulation. So the fact that he saw this multiple ring, multiple layers of black that can slowly move left and right in that tube, that is not a radio wave, because the radio wave is moving a nanosecond per foot in free space. And in that tube, if you tell me it moves half a nanosecond per foot, I'll believe you. But it's in that vicinity. Unless he's got nanosecond-like electronics timing, he can't be doing what we think he's doing. I think we're looking at some kind of a plasma arcing phenomena which is independent of an RF wave. The way high voltage arcing takes place can give you all kinds of crazy effects that are not a radio wave per se. Into XJN, K2LIW.
Well, the thing is that the Brackhausen effect is related to ferromagnetic materials, magnetizing small distinct intervals rather than smooth continuous matter. And he theorized that it could be used in wire coils as well, but we don't have any ferromagnetic material over there.
So do any of the adjacent YouTube videos by that guy or that group give us any other hints as to what is the schematic diagram of the electronics that was firing that tube over U.S. K2LIW?
Original electronic that was firing the tube was the spark up, so it was a continuous spark up, continuous flow of plasma, and the high voltage was connected to it. So that was was the electronics. Then later on, the 555 was employed by some others. But you see the effect, and you see that he can move that spot left to right. And definitely I have a difficulty to assign that to Brackhausen effect, as you say. And to agree.
Okay, I'll agree it's probably not Brackhausen. But there are many kinds of arcing effects. And I think you're saying there was a spark gap on the outside of the tube. There was a high voltage supply, a spark gap, and then the tube completes the circuit, is what I think you're describing. And did one of the YouTube videos show that schematic circuit, Wes? Go ahead.
I didn't see that, but that's the whole idea of the device. The device was used for treating cancer, whatever, in 1900s. Wacky medicine. So it's not something that was made recently. It's a flow of plasma. Now, in the flow of plasma, you're creating a medium plasma by itself is creating a signal, then this signal is delivered to the tube. Now, in the tube you have a plasma as well, but the plasma is a matter. And we have a matter that is interacting. And then what is it that is in the middle?
Right now, I don't know. Was that tube used in the 1900s for cancer cure? Was that supposed to be producing X-rays or ultraviolet? What was that supposed to be producing that was curative? Over to U.S.
I believe it was a X-ray. Because I found there was information when I was Googling for X-ray spectrometry. I have some of the wacky machine explanation, but it's not the time for it. We have 2 minutes left.
Yeah, most of the X-ray tubes that I've seen, the anode is a large structure with a flat plate to it at a 45-degree angle, and therefore high-speed electrons get accelerated across the X-ray tube. They slam into that 45-degree mirror, I'm going to call it, and the X-rays now come off to one side. I didn't see that kind of a structure in this tube. Therefore, I'm having trouble believing that this tube really produces X-rays. Over to you, Wes.
I wouldn't say so. The nature of every spark gap is the X-ray by itself. And you do have a significant amount of X-ray being created, but at the same time, you have a rarefied air, or you have some sort of gas over there. But say it's a rarefied gas, air. Now, in rarefied air, it is a perfect medium to create the X-ray waves and to achieve.
Yeah, many of the X-ray tubes that I've seen, there's a very hard vacuum inside. They're running on numbers like 300,000, 100,000 volts. Let me drop them. 100,000 volts is being applied to give you an extremely high acceleration of those electrons that when they slam into the target, they give you hard enough X-rays to have significant penetration of the material. So you don't want air in the tube, otherwise the electrons hitting the air would slow them down and you wouldn't get very many X-rays. That tube is filled up with a lot of ionizing material. Therefore, if X-rays are coming out of the tube, I think they're going to be extremely soft X-rays. If you told me that that tube is making ultraviolet, I'm going to believe you. But I think the X-rays coming out of there, if there are any, I think they're going to be very soft, because it doesn't have the mechanism to give you high velocity of those electrons. Back to you, Wes.
Well, the nature of X-ray is the vacuum tube that has the rarefied air. If you go to X-ray tube in Wikipedia, it says they use the X-ray tube is a vacuum to produce X-ray. They are used in X-ray machine. X-rays are part of electromagnetic spectrum whatsoever. It's a rarefied and what. So they could use the medium on it, but most likely that they use rarefied air. And then it's not important for me if this is the X-ray. Important for me is that we have a sort of phenomena standing for the sending wave, because there is no other explanation for that. And to exceed.
How do we know that the standing wave is not a stroboscopic effect with the camera, Wes? And by the way,